Good evening. This is Cinephobia Radio. If you are out there listening on your own, pick up the phone and call someone. Please don't do it tonight. We have a very exciting show for you. Cinephobia Radio. So there you are. This is Malcolm McDowell, or at least I look similar to Malcolm McDowell. Not quite sure whether I'm feeling myself tonight, but when I say feeling myself, I mean feeling well myself. Anyway, enjoy the show. Listen well. Listen well, my little droogies. Listen well.
Greetings from a dead man. This is Stuart Feedback Andrews, and you're listening to Cinephobia Radio, Episode 1. I'm kicking off this series with one of the best bits of audio I've cobbled together over the years, a Q&A with the one and only Malcolm McDowell, recorded at the 2007 Festival of Fear in Toronto. Mr. McDowell has over 150 film and television credits to date, including a celebrated trilogy of films with the late great British director Lindsay Anderson. But he will perhaps forever be known for the role he was born to play. Of course, I'm talking about Alex Delarge in Stanley Kubrick's 1971 nihilistic masterpiece, A Clockwork Orange. So without further ado, here he is, the man, the myth, the legend, and the only being in the universe capable of killing Captain Kirk, Mr. Malcolm McDowell.
The Durango 95 purred away real horror show. A nice, warm, vibratory feeling all through your gutty woods. Soon it was trees and dark, my brothers. With real country dark.
The first question I want to ask you is, how did you get the acting bug? What was the initial impetus?
Well, I was a show-off at school. I remember singing in church. We went to church twice a day at the school I went to, and which was a minor public school. As Lindsay Anderson used to say, yes, Malcolm, I went to a major public school. You went to a minor one. And he was right, actually. The headmaster heard me singing and invited me to be in a musical of Aladdin. So when I was 11 years old, I played Aladdin. The first time I went onto a stage in front of an audience with the lights, I felt at home. And from there on in, I played in all the things and all that at school. So that when I left school, I was supposed to go to university, but I wanted to get out and be an actor. And so I went to work in my father's pub as a wine waiter. It wasn't very successful. And I ended up selling coffee in Yorkshire, where they normally just drink tea. And anyway, I ended up as an actor in repertory theatre and at the Royal Shakespeare Company. And then, thank God, I met the great Lindsay Anderson. And he was, he changed my life completely, not only professionally, but personally as well. He was absolutely one of the most extraordinary men I ever met, and as near as a genius as you'll ever get on this planet. He was also a very, he wasn't an easy man. And he was a curmudgeon. He had a terrible temper. And I knew all this. And, we had terrible rows. It was quite hilarious, actually. But I knew that at the end of the day, it would be me that had to pick up the phone and apologize. Because that was the price of being a great friend, to him. And so I did a one-man show about my relationship with him. And it's called Never Apologize. And they filmed it, and it's going to come out on DVD at some point. So if you can ever catch that, you'll understand where I came from and what formed me as an actor and as a person. Really, they are inseparable, of course, from the person or the actor. So when I started in these films, If, Clockwork Orange, Oh Lucky Man, they were... I was very lucky to be the sort of standard bearer of youthful rebellion, as it was then.
The thing I hate about you, Roundtree, is the way you give Coca-Cola to your scum and your best teddy bear to Oxfam, and expect us to lick your frigid fingers for the rest of your frigid life.
you know, it wasn't by design, it was by luck, basically, that I got cast in this amazing film, If.
If you're not aware of If, If was a 1968 film, the first collaboration between Malcolm and Lindsay Anderson, a political revolutionary allegory about a public school. Malcolm McDowell plays a right bastard instigator in that movie, and it made him a huge star in England. This is long before, well, not long before, but it's before Clockwork Orange, so in England we already recognised Malcolm McDowell as an absolute star. Before we talk about Oh Lucky Man, there was a little film, some of you may have heard of it, that happened in between those two films. Mm. Of course, I'm talking about A Clockwork Orange.
Actually, Clockwork, which is, you know, I suppose it's, I peaked rather early as an actor, you know. But actually, after we shot If, Lindsay said to me, well, Malcolm, it's going to be downhill from here on in.
How wrong he was.
Yes, I'm glad to prove him wrong. At least
so
one.
How did you sort of come into Kubrick's sights for the role
well,
of Alex?
Kubrick, I got a call from Stanley Kubrick. And to be honest with you, I wasn't quite sure who he was. I thought maybe it was Stanley Kramer. there was a little confusion, you know, there. I didn't realize that I didn't, you know, I was a young actor. I was, you know, I was working odd jobs, trying to survive, really, in London as an actor. And most of the time, you're out of work, let's face it. Pretty much the way it is now, actually, but they just pay me a little more money now. But I got the call from him. And I remember calling Lindsay Anderson and said, do you know Stanley Kubrick? And he said, Malcolm, for God's sake, you're an ignoramus. He said, he's just made this film, 2001, I'll take you to see it. I had no money to. So he took me to see this, and I sat there at the Cinerama in the West End in London, and, you know, these floating spaceships, and I kept saying, not much character here, is there? I said, the main character's a bloody computer, for God's sake. But, of course, it's a masterpiece, isn't it? It's one of the great, great science fiction films ever made. And, you know, Stanley, that was a breakthrough film in that genre. And anyway, I went to see him, and I didn't realize that Stanley had seen If, because his widow, Christiana, told me a year ago that Stanley, you know, he used to show films at his house, and he saw If, because it was this big hit in England, as you said. And when I came on the screen, he turned to Christiana and said, we've found our Alex. He says, stop the film. They had to relace it. And he went and they literally replayed my entrance, Christiana told me, 5 times. And he was intently watching. And he knew just from that, when I pulled, there's a shot when I come back to school with a scarf around my head and a big hat. I take the hat off. I'm looking in a mirror. And I pull the scarf down. And I've grown this moustache in the holidays. Of course, you're not allowed a moustache at school. And had to shave it off. And he knew then that I was going to be his Alex. And so I met him. I read the book. Didn't understand it. Read it a second time. Thought, wow, this would make a pretty cool film. Read it the third time. And I thought, holy God, what a great part. And so began my great relationship with Stanley Kubrick, and I really loved him. He is an amazing man. He was completely the antithesis of what Lindsay Anderson was. Lindsay Anderson was a humanist. He loved people. Stanley could take them or leave them. Basically, he was more interested in the camera lenses than he was in people, and he didn't understand actors at all. I mean, not at all. He thought acting was literally just learning the lines. I had to explain to him that really the lines are the last thing to worry about. He was always freaking out about actors not knowing their lines and you know, wasting time. I went, Stanley, you take 5 hours to light a shot. What are you talking about? I said, if an actor blows a line, what is it, one take? I said, they never hold you up. Anyway, he was an extraordinary man, and I never heard him raise his voice. He was always very quiet on the set, and I remember saying to him, Stanley, early on in the film, what would you like me to do in this scene? He looked at me absolutely shocked, and he just said, gee, Malcolm, I'm not Rada, and walked off. Now, Rada is the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, you know. That's where you go to learn how to act. I said, Stanley, excuse me for asking, but I must have made a mistake. I saw the call sheet the morning, and it said, Director S. Kubrick. I said, maybe you'd like to give me a little direction, or maybe I'll ask one of the grips. So he did manage to laugh at that. And my relationship, honestly, with him was one of pulling his leg as hard as I could and just completely, you know, freaking him out and joking around. And through that, you know, the film got Singing in the Rain. It was an ad lib of mine, you know, all improvised. It got all the stuff at the end, you know, when the woman comes in and shows me the pictures and I'm in the... All that's just thrown away stuff and improvisation and because I knew he would love... He loved the blacker the humor, the better. And when I first did the feeding scene in the hospital, like this, I looked over at Stanley and he's literally had his handkerchief stuffed in his mouth and he was crying, he was laughing so much. Because honestly, it kicks the film into a different realm. You know, it's really the wrap-up of the film and it's sort of boring, you know. Basically, it's boring. You hear this guy just, it's a two-page speech. At a time when you don't need a two-page speech, you just need a visual and some energy, you know. And he realized that was perfect. And he said, just do more of it, do more. Every time he gets to a point and he has to cut and put the food in my mouth. Anyway, so because my relationship was that way with him, we got a lot of great stuff in the film. You know, it was the part of a lifetime, but in the end...
I have to ask you, how did you so intimately connect with that character? Like, what was it about Alex Delarge that you just found this intense
nerve
with?
Well, you know, the truth is I had no idea how to play the part. I mean, absolutely no idea. And I asked, before I started shooting, I asked Lindsay Anderson to read the script, to see if he could give me any pointers. Which he did, and he called me and said, you better come over. I thought, oh, God, you know. When I got to his flat, he said to me, well, thank God I'm not directing this. I went, look, it's not your kind of thing, but he said, well, look, Malcolm, I'll tell you one thing about this character. There's a shot of you in If, a close-up when you walk in to be beaten by the head boy. There's a close-up of you when you open the doors of the gymnasium and you look at them and you... smile. He said, that's how you play this part. Ah, Lindsay, the genius that he was, he knew that that piece of direction was all I needed, and that's all it took. And for the first day, which actually the first day of shooting was me having a shot in my ass of distilled water. Stanley, you know, he wanted to be real about it. And so, of course, when the needle went in my ass, I just smiled. Oh! The person administering the hypodermic was an Australian actress called Madge Ryan. She played one of the doctors. And I saw her practicing on an orange in the corridor as I was walking from one set to another. And I walked past and I said, what's she doing? She went, oh, she's practicing getting it. I went, holy Christ. Okay, well. So we get to the scene, and Madge Ryan starts. You know, she's going to give me the shot, you know, real shot. I mean, it's so easy to fake a hypodermic. You know, it just goes in. Nobody knows. I mean, it's stupid. But it was my first day. I wasn't going to argue with this famous director, you know. So, you know, I take my pajamas down, give her my ass, you know, and I see her, and she's literally shaking, which did not inspire much confidence. And she'd obviously been told not to mess around, just get the needle into him. She threw it in like it was going into a fucking rhinoceros. Up to the hilt. I looked as this thing sailed into my arse, and she had this dialogue, and she was still shaking with nerves about the whole thing, that she squirted it straight into my arse instead of really just taking it very... A huge welt came onto my bottom, and I went this way, screaming. So, that was the end of that. And then... Then he goes, okay, we'll just do a close-up and we'll use the fake needle. So that's what you get in the film.
1973, I'd say the other part of your career that you were born to play, Oh Lucky Man. Tell us a little bit about that film, your second film with Lindsay Anderson.
Well, you know, this is how Oh Lucky Man came to be, was that we were at the Cannes Film Festival. And we had just announced that we had won the grand prize. The Palme d'Or was won by IF in 1969. And now, I was a very cocky young actor, and I presumed that, you know, that we'd make another film. I went up to Lindsay and I said, Linz, you know, we're such a great team. You know, what's going to be our next film? Now, he looked at me like I'd crawled out of a rock. With such contempt, I can see his face to this day. He said, good God, Malcolm, what do you think, good scripts fall from the trees? He goes, if you want to work with me again, you better well write something. And I went, well, fuck you, I will. Easier said than done. You know, an actor, we don't make good writers. But anyway, I went back to London and I started writing my experiences as a coffee salesman. And I'd written about 40 pages, and I was very proud of it. I thought, this is the beginnings of a very nice little comedy. So I said, it's time for you to read, Lindsay, what I've written. And it was called Coffee Man. He went, oh, Coffee Man, what is this? I said, just read it. He goes, is it supposed to be funny? I said, it is funny. It's a comedy. Of course, I'm from the north of England, of course, where we have a sense of humour. You're from the south. You have no idea.
Very true, very true.
He said, actually, I'm from Scotland. I said, yeah, right. You're only from Scotland when the bill comes at the end of the meal. He started to read the 40 pages, and, I mean, I was about to start the Kubrick film, and I was very excited because, you know, I wanted to work with him again because I knew that this was the man whose destiny mine was tied to, and I just wanted to work with him. He was a great artist. Anyway, he read it, and he was sighing, rolling his eyes, and he goes, "Oh, Malcolm, it's not very good, is it?" I said, yes, it is, and it's your next film. He said, is it? Well, then you'd better call David Sherwin, who had written If. So I called David, he read it, and we were having dinner at my little flat, and we were in the kitchen. He said, go into the bedroom and read it. It was only a two-bedroom thing, a two-room flat. And he went into the bedroom to read it while we were in the kitchen. He came out and he went, this is bloody fantastic. This is so funny. I went, you must be from the north of England. He said, no, this is what I want to work on. So we worked every day in pubs, coffee houses, writing the stuff, and I would go, right, Mick goes to, boom, and then David would write it down and go, ooh, and anyway, we're in a pub, and I said, you know, David, this is ridiculous, you know, because the title, Coffee Man, it's not very epic, is it? It sounds like Carry On Up the Coffee Man or something, you know, so I said, it's really not, you know, it's not got the weight that I think that a Lindsay Anderson film, you know, deserves. And he went, you know, I said, what's this film about? And he goes, oh, I don't know, success, luck. I went, luck, lucky man. That's it, lucky man. We went straight round to Lindsay Anderson's, and I said, you know, we banged on the door. And he goes, what on earth do you want? I said, just sit down. I'm going to whisper the name, the title of your next film. He said, oh, don't be so bloody ridiculous, Malcolm. For God's sake, get on with it. So I said, sit down, I'm going to whisper it and let it just permeate right through your body. So he was getting really irritated. I love to irritate him, you know. Like, and he sat down and I just went, lucky man. Roman nose, Roman haircut. Oh, lucky man. Yes!
Anyone who hasn't seen that film, that's your homework this week. You're going to go and rent it, you're going to go and buy it, and we're going to rediscover the brilliant Lindsay Anderson film, Oh Lucky Man, in North America.
A DVD comes out in October that Warners are putting out, and I've been trying to get them to put it out for 5 years, and I had to blackmail them. I said I would do the commentary for Clockwork Orange only if they would put out a DVD of Oh Lucky Man. So it comes out, thank God, in October.
Okay, from the really the high points of your career to one of the notoriously low points, I have to ask you about Caligula.
What's it like with Marcellus?
What's what like?
He's so fat. He's disgusting.
He's not. He's only large.
But tiny where it counts.
How do you know?
I saw him at the baths.
It's a piece of shit, but
you were quite incensed with what Bob Guccione did to that piece of work.
You know, it's one of those films that really... there's a great film dying to get out of this film. You know, it potentially has some wonderful, you know, set pieces in it. It's unfortunately, you know, it was paid for by Bob Guccione, the pornographer. So... You know, he 2 years after we'd finished shooting, he went in added obvious sort of lesbians doing every, you know, I mean, listen, I got nothing against lesbians, me watching them, I love it, you know, but not in the middle of a serious film about, you know, and I, you know, and then, you know, three, whatever, you know, just, you know, regular porn. And, you know, he saw the dailies that we were doing in Rome and he was incensed that there were no, you know, pretty women. And because the director just went and found, you know, people from the Piazza Navona, real Romans, you know. most of them were heroin addicts, but that's another story. But, you know, he wanted shots of penthouse pets with fake tits and no pubic hair, I suppose. I don't know. And, you know, Romans, they don't even shave under their armpits, you know. So... he sent over three pets, which was a hilarious day because they thought they were going to be in the new James Bond film. I said, "No, darling, that's not in Rome. That's being filmed in Malta. You've got to stop over here. You're in this Sodom and Gomorrah first, and then you'll probably end up with James Bond." You know, so it was hilarious. But basically, you know, it was a load of crap. You know, your career. If I waited for the great scripts to come down, I think I would have only made 5 movies. So, and I've made 125. So there you are. Most of them are crap.
So this was around the time that you made the move permanently to Hollywood. Time after time. I know there's a lot of fans of the film here.
Yeah.
Why did you make the move permanently at this point in your career?
Well, it was nothing that was planned. You know, I read the script of Time After Time when I was finishing up with Caligula. And I would have done anything to have gotten away from this sort of monstrous, crazed emperor. You know, I was just dying to do something that was a little more mainstream and a little more sort of charming and fun. And, you know, it was hard holding together this film in Rome after a while. It went on for almost a year. Anyway, Time After Time came to me, and it's such a charming script that I, of course, immediately said I'd love to do it and I was really thrilled not to be asked to play Jack the Ripper. That went to my good friend, David Warner, who's a wonderful actor who I knew very well from the Royal Shakespeare Company, and he's a great actor, and I'm very happy to say he's still acting and he's still great. And eventually they cast Mary Steenburgen as this girl, the sort of modern-day woman, and you know, things happen on the set. I broke the golden rule. I fell in love with my leading lady, which you never are supposed to do. Because it always ends up in disaster.
I'm a 20th century woman. I have a career and a mind of my own. Be reasonable. How am I going to make it in 1893?
Is your work so important? It's your life we're talking about.
My work is my life.
Well, it was fine for a few years. But anyway, I ended up marrying Mary and changing my whole life. She had a very wonderful career, and she won the Academy Award, Best Supporting Actress, for Melvin and Howard, the next film she did. And so there was no question of going back to England. And then, we started to have children. And we had two children. And then when we split up eventually after 7 years or whatever it was, it's always 7 years, isn't it? There was really no question of me going back to England because, I was the father of these children. And if I wanted to abandon the children and carry on with my career, I suppose I would have just left. But I did not want to leave my children. And so I, of course, it wasn't even a question. It never came up. I just moved out of the house and moved down the street. And that was it. So, and we are great friends today, I'm glad to say. Not with my children, of course, that goes without saying. I'm talking about the ex-wife. And we all live together in the same little town in California with my new wife, two new sons, and we all, we all managed to get on quite nicely.
Lovely. So 1982 saw you incestuously frolicking with the indescribably beautiful Natasha Kinski in The Cat People. Ooh.
Gorgeous, yeah.
Talk about old lucky man.
Yeah, I was very lucky. Unfortunately, I was playing her brother.
Only you can stop this killing. You've got to make love with me. As brother and sister. We can live together as mates. Just as our parents did. You do know that they were brother and sister, don't you? Oh, yeah.
She was, she was exquisite. I mean, a very beautiful girl, and I've seen her recently and she's still very beautiful, of course. Why wouldn't she be? That was a strange experience. Paul Schrader directed it, wrote the script. Now, he was having a thing with Natasha, so of course, and that all kind of went a bit wobbly in the middle, and I was kind of in the middle of that, and which I did not want to be, but it was quite a good film. It's quite a nice film actually, Cat People, and I'm quite proud of it. I think Blue Thunder right after that, and then I went back to the theater, which is really where my roots were and where my first love is really the theater, even though I've done so little of it really. I mean, you can't be everywhere at one time, but...
Before I open it up for questions, I want to ask you about a clever little cameo that you did in the Rob Altman film, The Player. How did that situation evolve, and where did that line come from?
It was, of course, an ad-lib, and I'd had this conversation with the head of... with a producer, actually, who I'd heard had been bad-mouthing me on a plane. And I saw him at a screening in Hollywood... I'm going back 30 years, but when I first went to Hollywood. And he came up to me all smiles and bonhomie, and not knowing, of course, that I'd heard about this. And he shook my hand, and as he shook my hand, I pulled him right into my face, and I said, the line. I said, listen, if you want to badmouth me, you say it to my face, not behind my back. And then this guy, who I'm not going to tell you who it was, he went to head up, I think, three of the major studios, which, of course, I never worked at. So how stupid was I with my big mouth? But it did give me one good line in a Robert Altman film.
Griffin? Griffin?
Malcolm McDowell.
Hi, how are you?
Just here. Listen, the next time you want to badmouth me, have the courage to do it to my face. You guys are all the same.
Time for a couple of quick questions.
Intelligent ones.
This fella here, the assistant warden, he's got his hand up.
How did you feel about performing the Singing in the Rain sequence in A Clockwork Orange?
The question was, how did you feel about acting in the notorious Singing in the Rain sequence, one of the most deliciously sacrilegious cinematic moments ever?
Well, as I told you, that was an improvisation. And what happened was that we were supposed to come into this house and threaten this writer and his wife. I was supposed to rape her and, you know, it was all a bit, in the script, it was all a bit realistic and not very interesting, nasty, actually, really horrible. And, you know, we were supposed to throw bottles of booze through the window and menace, you know, but stuff everyone had seen a million times before. And literally we sat on the set like this. There are stills of me just kind of sitting there like this, you know, while Stanley, I thought, I'll let him figure it out. I'm going to stay in the background, see what he comes up with. Well, after 5 days, he changed the furniture in the house about 5 times. He came up to me and he said, "Can you dance?" And I went, "Can I dance? I'm singing in the rain." And he immediately realized that this was fantastic. And he did one of these to me. We went and got in his car, drove to his house, which was about 15 minutes away, and he bought the rights for Singing in the Rain for $10,000. It took a week to shoot. And the postscript to that was that I was in Hollywood a year later when the film was, you know, a huge success. And I was at a party, you know, in Hollywood with all the old timers, you know. And somebody said, "Malcolm, I want to introduce you to Gene Kelly." And I went, "Oh, great." You know, as I thought, you know, I paid homage to him, you know, by singing his song, you know. I mean, listen, the thing was, I sang Singing in the Rain because my character was supposed to be euphoric. I was raping and pillaging. And that's when that character was happy. So, hey, you know, Hollywood gave us happy in Singing in the Rain, right? I mean, that's propaganda for you. And anyway, so I came up, he was had his back to me, turned around, and the guy goes, "Oh, I'd like to introduce Malcolm McDowell." He took one look, turned, and walked off. You know what? I didn't blame him. He's such a great artist and such a brilliant person that really, mm-hmm. you know, I ripped him off, okay? Sorry.
We could bring Kayvon up on stage and he could reenact that scene for us.
Yeah, you could, but...
okay, a couple of quick questions here of films that we haven't discussed already.
Why did not Britannia Hospital get the same critical acclaim as the film, If, and Oh Lucky Man?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. Firstly, Maggie Thatcher had just started the Falklands War the very day, I think, that it opened. So it got massacred by the critics as being sort of unpatriotic. Those poor fuckers, you know. And I think also that, you know, it's Lindsay's most bitter film. And because he lost his mother to the English Health Service. And, you know, regardless of what they say in Sicko, the British National Health Service is a disaster. You want to get an operation, you get in line and wait 3 years. By that time, you're dead. If I was sick in England, I would crawl to the plane to get back to the States. And I'm serious. I'm sorry, Michael Moore, but you are wrong on that one, buddy.
This is disgraceful.
Disgraceful. There can be no excuse for this kind of behavior.
We've got to cut this short.
This is disgraceful.
Lindsay Anderson's Britannia Hospital. Will we ever recover?
This fella right there.
What was it like working with Rob Zombie on the new Halloween?
Rob Zombie rocks. I tell you, I'd make the telephone book with Rob Zombie. And he'd make it violent and loud.
Last question. I'm going to ask it myself, sorry.
Good.
If we don't cover this, I'll get strangled, I'm sure. You killed Captain Kirk. Why the hell did you do that? That wasn't a nice thing to do.
As I said at the time, bring on Picard. Let's get rid of both of them.
Thank you very much. Right, and thank you all for coming. Cheers.
And so ends the inaugural edition of Cinephobia Radio. For the full-length version of this episode and many more, visit the website at www.cinephobia-radio.com. So until next time, vidi well, my brothers and sisters, vidi well.